Tennessee.
You are listening to the only destination for local music, sports, and news. CFRC 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca.
Good evening, it is 5 p.m. and this is Today in YGK on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. Today in YGK is brought to you by CFRC's News Collective, Christina Laurie, Jesse Bell, Lauren Tucker, Dinah Jansen, and Paige Lang. CFRC's news programming is made possible by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and here are your local news headlines. Tonight, we have plenty of messages directly from the city of Kingston. To start us off, 2000 Front Road Community Update. A connected and accessible waterfront and increasing opportunities for urban farming are cornerstones of the city of Kingston's Waterfront Master Plan and 2023-26 strategic priorities, respectively. The waterfront farm property at 2000 Front Road, known to many as the Lemoyne Point Farm, has held the interest of the city for several years and provides opportunities for the city to advance both initiatives. Mary Frazier, the property's longtime owner, passed away in 2022. Her will gives the city an option to purchase the property on a number of terms, including keeping, as far as possible, the property zoned for rural use. The city and Ms. Frazier's estate trustees disagree on how to interpret parts of Ms. Frazier's will. As a result, the estate trustees have applied to the court for advice and direction on the interpretation of the will. The city recognizes the importance of respecting Ms. Frazier's intentions, as well as the property's natural and cultural heritage significance to the residents of Kingston. The city is committed to continuing to work with the estate trustees through negotiation, mediation, or if necessary, litigation to advance the city's interpretation of Ms. Frazier's will. The city appreciates the input of community organizations and residents and remains open to hearing from community members who share the vision of protecting this unique part of Kingston's waterfront and history. In another update from the city, new road and paths opening on Cataraqui Woods Drive Extension. Pedestrians, cyclists, and motorists alike can enjoy the newly opened Cataraqui Woods Drive Extension in Kingston's West End. The new section of roadway, which began construction in fall of 2021, will be opening for use, connecting Simbim Road to Centennial Drive and further west to Princess Street. The transportation project manager with the City of Kingston states, quote, "This new section of Cataraqui Woods Drive provides a safe route to walk, bike, roll, or drive through the area. It offers a more direct and efficient route along this corridor while also helping avoid unnecessary traffic through residential streets in the surrounding neighborhoods." End quote. A new multi-use path, an off-road shared area for pedestrians and cyclists, was included along the south side of Cataraqui Woods Drive within the project area. This path connects the existing multi-use path on Centennial Drive, leading to the K&P Trail. The new section of roadway also includes a sidewalk on the north side and on-road bike lanes with a buffer to separate cyclists and motorists. While the road, sidewalk, and paths are open for use, some remaining works will take place at a later date. With the support of Utilities Kingston, street lighting is scheduled to be installed later this summer. Learn more about other municipal transportation projects planned in Kingston on Get Involved Kingston. Coming up this weekend, giveaway day is August 17th. Adam Mueller, operations manager of solid waste services at the City of Kingston, states, quote, "Giveaway days are an effective and unique way to reduce waste in Kingston. When you pick up free secondhand items, you not only save them from the landfill, you also reduce the waste associated with packaging and the greenhouse gas emissions associated with manufacturing new goods. Giving away items also helps community members save money," end quote. Share pictures of your giveaway day items on Instagram or Twitter at hashtag WasteNotYGK. Giveaway day guidelines. Only set out appropriate items that you know someone else might want. Appropriate items include books, CDs, DVDs, furniture and small appliances, electronics, construction materials, kitchen gadgets, dishes, cutlery, pots and pans, and yes, unwanted gifts. The Consumer Product Safety Bureau of Health Canada advises that the following items should not be given away or picked up: baby walkers, cribs, car seats, strollers, playpens, bath seats, mattresses, blinds, and toys. How to put items out. Place items at the curb in front of your home. Place stickers or signs on the items with the word free. ensure any items that you do not want taken are kept away from items placed at the curb. At the end of the day, bring any uncollected items back into your home. The city will not collect unwanted items left at the curb. Consider donating them to a local charity. How to pick items up. Respect other people's property. Don't walk on lawns or gardens. Take only the items that are marked as free and placed at the curb. Don't leave previously picked up items on the curb at other people's property. Find these guidelines on the City of Kingston website. That wraps up your headlines for this evening, and next up is your CFRC Arts Desk with Lauren Tucker.
Thanks so much, Christina. Here's your arts and culture news for today. Continuing this month at the TED until August 31st, we'll be contemplating Glaciers, A Dialogue, a solo exhibition from Jan Kabatoff, curated by Jessica Turner, and this exhibition will include photography, sculpture, paintings, video, audio, and even a virtual reality element using the Oculus headset, as well as footage from a documentary on the melting of the Athabasca Glacier, which is currently in production from this creative team. All ages are welcome to peruse this exhibition in the TED Center Gallery, and it is free to do so, though exhibition hours may vary. You can tune into last week's Kingston Curator to hear an interview about the project with curator Jessica Turner. There's also new events and exhibitions all the time at the TED, so you can learn more at tedcenter.org. This year's Kick and Push Festival, now in its 10th year as an interactive local theater festival, launched on July 25th and runs until August 18th across Kingston. Kick and Push specializes in one-of-a-kind, unexpected, and immersive shows that take the audience beyond passive observers, ranging from venues like the Grand Theater to the TED Center to the more unexpected. There's still some programming left to catch this week, and you can visit thekickandpush.com for more information. Registration for fall term programming at the Kingston School of Art is now open, including programs for youth and adults, as well as workshops and summer camps. This season includes adult classes in drawing, fiber and textile arts, mixed media, painting, printmaking, and sculpture. Youth programs are available for kids ages 6 to 16, as well as families, and there are also a variety of 1 and 2 day workshops available for registration. Applications are also now open for the first annual KSOA member show, and members can submit pieces on their website now. For more information and to register, visit ksoa.info. At Modern Fuel Art Gallery, in partnership with the Union Gallery, is the Twofold Artist-in-Residence Program, led by co-directors Jill Glatt and Berlin Reed. This program provides an opportunity for local BIPOC artists to dive into their practices, collaborations, and discussions while having access to designated workspaces, professional development and mentorship, communal events, and a studio visit platform. This year's artists-in-residence are Shanique Pert, Alicia Udvari, Shamara Pert, and Samara Khan, who worked at the Union Gallery in July, and Modern Fuel Art Gallery now in August. For more information, visit uniongallery.queensu.ca. This and every summer Tuesday, you can head on down to Springer Market Square for Salsa in the Square. From 6:30 to 7:30 p.m., enjoy a free beginner class, and then hit the open dance floor until 10 p.m. Also, every Wednesday summer evening, enjoy Swingin' Summer, a live music throwback to the era of romantic, joyful, and jazzy songs from 7 to 8 p.m. And every summer Friday evening, Springer Market Square hosts Kickin' It Country from 7 to 8 p.m., featuring live local country music. For more on these events, visit downtownkingston.ca. Every Monday at Daft Brewing, Bon Evans hosts Music Trivia Mondays at 7 p.m. Put your music knowledge to the test in 4 more rounds of trivia, whether you're going it solo or in a team, with clips, questions, and more. The winning team walks away at the end of the night with a $50 gift card and bragging rights, so be sure to check it out for a Monday night of music and fun. Kingston welcomes back Movies in the Square and Springer Market Square on Thursday evenings this summer, and the full lineup has now been announced. This week, August 15th, Freaky Friday starts at dusk. You can also catch Night at the Museum Battle of the Smithsonian on August 22nd and Lilo and Stitch on August 29th. Be sure to mark your calendars now and bring your blankets, chairs, and bug spray to experience your favorite films for free this summer under the stars. Coming up at Kingston's Independent Cinema, The Screening Room, you can catch special screenings of 1964's A Hard Day's Night, celebrating its 60th anniversary, on August 10th, 11th, 13th, and 15th. As well, 1940's Rebecca will be playing on August 17th, 18th, 20th, and 22nd as part of the Summer Alfred Hitchcock Presents series. You can also catch 2016's The Love Witch on August 11th and 1977's Three Women on August 18th as part of the Summer Movie Night screening by the Cinema Society of Kingston. As well, 1974's Phantom of Paradise will be playing its 50th anniversary screenings on August 17th, 20th, 21st, and 22nd. Also coming up at the screening room is Cat Video Fest 2024 from August 17th to 22nd, a fundraiser where 10% of all ticket sales will be donated to Kingston Animal Rescue, featuring compilations of the latest and best cat videos on the internet. There's also new arrivals and special screenings all the time, so be sure to check back at screeningroomkingston.com for all of your cinema adventures. That's all I've got for UN Arts Desk today. Now I'll turn it over to Jesse Bell at the Sports Desk.
This is Jesse Bell from the CFRC Sports Desk, and this is your sports report for Monday, August 12th. 2024. Today's sports report is the 11th part of a 12-part series previewing the upcoming OUA football season. Today's episode is about the Western Mustangs. 2023 was another sterling, stellar year for the Western Mustangs as they captured their third consecutive Yates Cup, once again on the friendly confines of Alumni Stadium. This time, though, they played the Wilfrid Laurier Golden Hawks. Though 2023 was another banner season for the Mustangs, it did not feel like a Western year for Western. And by that I mean, although they went 8-0 in the regular season, these were not all dominant blowouts as we have become accustomed to. In fact, there were several games, three that come to mind, where Western was trailing at various points in the second half, including deep into the fourth quarter. These observations are not confined just to the realm of the box score either. As someone who has watched a lot of Western Mustangs football, 2023 showed that the parity gap in the OUA is closing. Western did not dominate teams as they are accustomed to doing, and we saw a lot more competitive games and fight back than we've seen in years prior. Now, this is not to say that Western was anything other than the best football team in Ontario, because they were, and they are still one of the top two or three teams in all of Canada, and they should not be underestimated. This is just to say that the aura of infallibility, the aura of the unstoppable force, the immovable object, may not be there with Western as we have seen in years past. Teams see that they are human, teams see that they can hang, and teams see that they could possibly even win. Now, a fair counterpoint can be made in saying that the 2023 Western Mustangs were one of the younger championship squads Western has fielded, and that means they're going to get a lot of key starters on offense and defense back in 2024, including on the offensive side, Evan Hillock, Seth Robertson, and Savon Magne-Jones. This Western team is going to be dangerous, they are deep, they are extremely well coached, and they are the favorites for a reason. Looking at Western's schedule, of course, they will be the favored team in every single matchup in 2024, but there are some interesting ones worth highlighting, including a season opener on the road in Ottawa, and of course a trip down to Laurier for a game with the Golden Hawks. Western and Queens will play at Western's Alumni Stadium, which is going to be a tough game for the Gales, obviously. Most people, I think, are confident to predict an 8-0 season from Western. I am not one of them. I think Western will finish with a 7-1 record, ending up second in the OUA. The only team I feel that can beat them, and it's not just because I'm a homer, it's not just because I'm sentimental, it's because I have watched multiple games between these two squads, and the team that has been the closest to dethroning Western has been Queens, and it's only right that the team that does beat Western is Queens. 11 years to the day of their last victory, I think the Gales will pull it off in London on September 28th, but Western will still be heavily favored in the Yates Cup. They are an unstoppable team, but the Gales, all it takes is one lucky day to dethrone the best. That's a wrap for today's sports report, and while we're on the note of the Queens Western football game, I'm going to sign off and leave you with a promo hyping up that September 28th clash between the Gales and the Mustangs.
347,155,200 seconds. 5,785,920 minutes. 96,432 hours. 4,018 days. 574 weeks. 13 games. 11 long, excruciating years. That's how long it's been since the Queen's Gaels last experienced victory over their most hated rivals, the Western Mustangs. On Saturday, September 28th, 2024, 11 years to the day of their last victory, the Gaels get their next shot at Ontario's best. CFRC will be there live to call all the action. Tune in at 12:45 p.m. for the pregame show. Kickoff is scheduled for 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
This is electric. This is unprecedented. This is Queens football on CFRC.
This is Christina coming in with your CFRC weather report for this evening. Tonight, we're expecting mainly cloudy skies with a 30% chance of showers early this evening and a risk of thunderstorm. We have a low of 14 degrees. Looking forward to tomorrow, Tuesday, August 13th, we're expecting sunny skies with a high of 28 degrees with humidex that's going to feel like 32. We also have a UV index of 7 or high. Tomorrow night, we'll have clear skies with a low of 15. On Wednesday, August 14th, we're expecting a mix of sun and cloud with a 30% chance of showers and a high of 28. Wednesday night, cloudy periods with a low of 16. On Thursday, August 15th, we'll have sunny skies and a high of 28. And Thursday night, cloudy periods with a low of 16. On Friday, the 16th of August, we're expecting some increasing cloudiness with a high of 28 degrees. And Friday night, cloudy skies with a 30% chance of showers and a low of 19 to finish off the week. That wraps up your weather report for this week, and next up is your CFRC Weekly Traffic Report. Now it's time for your CFRC Weekly Traffic Report for the week of August 9th to 15th. Pavement rehabilitations will take place along Highway 401 between Westbrook Road to beyond the Highway 15 overpass and on the Sir John A. McDonald overpass. This work will consist of various lane and ramp closures over the next several months. Highway 401 eastbound and westbound at Sir John A. McDonald Boulevard on and off-ramp closures. August 12th from 12 a.m. to 6 a.m. and 8 p.m. to 6 a.m. August 13th from 8 p.m. to 6 a.m. August 14th from 8 p.m. to 6 a.m. and August 15th from 8 p.m. to 6 a.m. PSPC wishes to advise users that the LaSalle Causeway is still fully closed to motorists, cyclists, and pedestrians until further notice. In road closures to look out for this week, Albert Street, Princess to 486 Albert, closed until December 31st to accommodate construction activity and staging at 484 Albert. Cooper Street, Albert to Collingwood, closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. For project details, you can visit Get Involved Kingston. Earl Street, University to Division, closed August 12th from 7 a.m. to August 16th at 5 p.m. for the reconstruction of Aberdeen Street. For details, you can visit Get Involved Kingston. Hillcrest Avenue, Kings Court to 7th, closed until September 1st for buried infrastructure replacement. The road will be open to local traffic. Johnson Street, Portsmouth to Robert Wallace, closed August 12th to 14th for gas main reconstruction. King Street, Plastarms to north end of King, closed until September 30th for the construction of new storm and roadbed. The road will be open to local traffic. Market Street, King to Ontario, closed August 9th from 7 a.m. to August 11th at 2 p.m. for the Thousand Islands Poker Run event. Sydenham Street, Princess to Queen, closed until September 27th for downtown Kingston BIA activations. Union Street, Victoria to Albert, closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. Project details are available at Get Involved Kingston. University Avenue, Union to Earl, closed for the removal of debris from the Queen's J-Duck project. Wellington Street, Main to George, closed until August 30th to accommodate construction-related activity for the Berryfield Highlands Subdivision Project. In parking disruptions, the Hanson Memorial Parking Structure Restoration Project is underway and is expected to conclude in late December 2024. The work will be completed in phases to allow the building to remain mostly open to public parking for the duration of the project. There is also parking available at the Chan Memorial and Robert Bruce Memorial parking garages in the two adjacent blocks to the west. In other delays to look out for, Aberdeen Street, Johnson to Earl, expect delays and closures along Aberdeen Street. Bay Ridge Drive, Princess to Taylor Kidd, expect delays while a contractor completes work for the Bay Ridge Drive active transportation upgrades. Collins Bay Road, Prince Charles Edwin to Princess, expect delays while a contractor completes upgrades for the Princess and Collins Bay active transportation improvements. Gardner's Road at Centennial and Creekford expect delays while a contractor completes intersection widening, traffic signal upgrades, and cycling and pedestrian improvements. Highway 2, Abidjan to St. Lawrence, expect a lane closure to complete enhanced flood protection of Abidjan Road, Highway 2, and St. Lawrence Avenue. The lane closure will be controlled by a temporary traffic signal. John Counter Boulevard at Montreal Street, expect delays while a contractor completes interim intersection improvements. Work will take place overnight from Sunday night to Friday mornings during the week, and on weekends during the day. For details on all of these projects, you can visit Get Involved Kingston. That wraps up your traffic report for this evening. Next up is Dinah Jansen and Lauren Tucker with your events and concerts calendars.
For today's live music lineup, I'll be featuring shows from fantastic local and visiting acts fast approaching to Kingston and surrounding area. Keep it locked because you won't want to miss these details. At Hotel Wolf Island on Monday, August 12th at 8 p.m. is Hugh Christopher Brown, Ron Hawkins, and Stephen Stanley in a one-night-only summer song circle. This is a no-minor show, doors are at 7 p.m., and tickets are $25, including tax. This and every Tuesday, head down to the club at RCHA from 4 to 7 p.m. for Tom's Tunes Day, an open mic jam with Tom Savage and friends. Admission is free. On Wednesday, August 14th, at the club at RCHA is Craig Jones and the Alternative Facts with an evening of guitar stylings. This show is at 7 p.m., doors are at 4 p.m., and tickets are $5. On Wednesday, August 14th, Toronto-based Start Run Radio will be bringing their funk, jazz, and soul sounds to Hotel Wolf Island. This show is free, all ages, and the show kicks off at 6 p.m. On Thursday, August 15th at the Cove Inn is singer-songwriter Tony Silvestri as a part of Original Thursdays. This is a 5 p.m. all-ages show and admission is by donation. Also on Thursday, August 15th at Hotel Wolf Island is Open Season Thursdays with Chris Brown, Joey Wright, and Jason Mercer, declaring open season on anything musical. Admission to this No Minor show is free and the show is at 7 p.m. On Friday, August 16th at the Cove Inn, Music Westport 2024 kicks off with Cobo Town at 8:30 p.m. Tickets are $90 plus HST and gratuity, which includes dinner, a donation to the Westport Arts Council, and the roots reggae and calypso stylings of this Toronto ensemble. This is an all-ages show and opening party, and doors are at 7 p.m. Also on Friday, August 16th, are Exogen, Don't Tell Sarah, Arachnia, and Filthy, presented by Filthy Band and Don't Tell Sarah at Overtime Sports Bar. This lineup of hard rock and alt metal kicks off at 8:30 p.m., and it is a no-minor show. Tickets are $10 and doors are at 8 p.m. As part of Music Westport 2024 at the Cove Inn in Lockwood Park on Saturday, August 17th, from 12 to 6 p.m., you can catch Emily Steele and the Deal, Dennis Bauman, Liberation Street Band, Frank Ryan, Sunfields, Sean Pynchon, The Gertrudes, Foster, and Shane Sudak. Admission is free, and you can visit westportartscouncil.com for more. Also on Saturday, August 17th at Hotel Wolf Island is jazz pop duo Clear from La Pêche, Quebec. This all-ages show is at 6 p.m., and admission is free. Also on Saturday, August 17th, The Mansion celebrates its 15th anniversary with Destroyer, Canada's Kiss tribute. Doors to this No Minor show open at 7 p.m. The show starts at 8 p.m. and tickets start at just over $22. At Leopard Frog Farm on Sunday, August 18th is the lively lyrical Kingston folk act, Night Sun. Doors are at 1:30 p.m. The show starts at 2 p.m. and this show is free for all ages to attend. Last but certainly not least, Kings of Queens will be performing a patio show at The Mansion on Sunday, August 18th. This is a no minor show with doors at 8 p.m. and the music starts at 9 p.m. Tickets are just under $16. For more on these awesome local shows, you can visit kingstonlive.ca. Now here's Dinah with your events calendar.
Thanks so much, and now it's time for your CFRC community events calendar. On Monday the 12th, Runner's Choice is running its free weekly run group where all ages and paces are welcome to join in the fun social walk or run along the KP Trail. Meet up with the group at Riverhead Brewing at 5:30 p.m. Folks can also head over to the Newlands Pavilion gazebo in McDonald Park from 6 to 8 p.m., where folks can join in the fun and enjoy some summer swing dancing. All levels of dancers are welcome. Also on Monday night, One-Eyed Jacks hosts trivia from 7 to 10 p.m., and you can also head over to the Brass, which hosts trivia from 8 to 10 p.m. On Tuesday, August 13th, you can head on over to Springer Market Square from 8:30 to 4 p.m. for the Kingston Public Market. The weekly fun run in front of Lululemon starts at 5:30 p.m. All levels of runners are welcome. You can also head over to Springer Market Square in the evening from 6:30 to 7:30 p.m. for free salsa in the square, where you can get free salsa lessons between 6:30 and 7:30, and then stick around and enjoy the dance floor until 10 p.m. Also happening on Tuesday, folks can hang out with the Urban Sketchers Kingston for some chatting and sketching at Portsmouth Olympic Harbor from 4:30 to 6 p.m. No experience is necessary. Just bring your own sketching supplies. On Wednesday, August 14th, both Something in the Water Brewing Company and Daft Brewing are hosting their trivia nights starting at 7 p.m. running through 9:30. Also on Wednesday, you can drop in the Rideau Heights Community Center for its fresh food market pop-up to keep your belly full without emptying your wallet, a Kingston Community Health Center's and Lionheart supported initiative. Musiki Life Drawing also takes place from 4:30 to 6:30 p.m. No experience is necessary and all ages are welcome, though the bar is only available to those 19 plus. Bring your own art supplies. Also on Wednesday evening, you could head over to Fort Henry for its sunset ceremony to check out the Fort Henry Guard on parade, capped off with cannon firing and fireworks between 7 and 8:30 p.m. On Thursday, August 15th, you can head over to Daft Brewing, which is hosting Queerioki, a free karaoke night open to all but hosted and geared towards the queer community and their allies. The fun runs from 8 to 11 p.m. Also on Thursday night, you can bring a lawn chair and a pal down to Springer Market Square for a free screening of the 2003 version of Freaky Friday. The film starts at dusk and is open to all ages. On Friday, August 16th, you can also head over to the Fresh Food Market at the YMCA. The market features local fresh and pre-made foods from 9:30 to 12:30 p.m., and it's free to attend. Also on Friday, Kingston Pen Tours is hosting an outdoor movie screening of Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban. Tickets are available at the gate. Doors open at 7 for an 8 p.m. showtime. On Saturday, August 17th, from 11 to 11, bring your family and friends to Greek Fest 2024 at 121 Johnson Street to enjoy great food, live music, and dance performances with proceeds supporting the Partners in Mission Food Bank. This Saturday as well, the Queen of Wheat is back at Spearhead Brewery from 7 to 10 p.m., hosted by local drag legend Rowena Way. Come for a free night of live singing, comedy, stories, and lip syncing. And also Saturday evening from 7:30 to 10 p.m., Queen's University PhD candidate Parissa Nozari is presenting an astrophysics talk on amateur astrophotography and will discuss dust in the interstellar medium and the inefficiency of star formation. After the talk, visitors can tour the observatory and view nearby celestial bodies through telescopes, weather permitting. And coming up on Sunday, August 18th, Queen's Athletics and Recreation is hosting its Solidarity Swim from 2:30 to 4 p.m. Trans, non-binary, genderqueer, gender fluid, and any other non-cisgendered person who wants a safer place to swim and meet new friends are welcome. Cisgendered friends and loved ones are also welcome. Folks can also visit the ARC website to learn more about gender-affirming swimwear subsidies for folks in need. Also, don't forget that each Sunday between 9 a.m. and 2 p.m., you can visit the Memorial Center Farmers Market and get great produce from local farms, plus artisanal crafts, as well as ready-to-eat food you can enjoy right on site. And finally, on Sunday, August 18th, grab your yoga mat and head down to Battery Park on the waterfront pathway for fresh air and positive vibes. The free yoga class is taught by a local instructor starting at 10 a.m. and is open to all ages and abilities.
Thank you for tuning in to CFRC's local news programming. To revisit episodes of Today in YGK and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Today in YGK is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What Will I Wear, 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
What'll I Wear offers the best in vintage, funky, one-of-a-kind treasures, clothing, accessories, and a fabulous selection of jewels, vintage and new. Find the cutest purse, the most dashing of hats and sunglasses, everything to complete your individual look. What'll I Wear has it all. They can dress you from top to bottom. Find your new fashion fave at What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street in Kingston. Visit their new location and follow them on Facebook to keep up to date with what's in store at What'll I Wear.
Good day. You're listening to Free City Radio. This is edition 227. I'm your host, Stefan Christoph, recording this edition from Lisbon, Portugal. On the program today, I am going to be sharing a conversation that I had with Ruth Marie Henkes, who is an activist and organizer based in Brussels, Belgium. Ruth Marie has been involved in a project called Code Red. It is a project to bring together different social movement forces to organize direct actions for climate justice. This interview looks at some specific actions that recently took place in the context of the Code Red project in Belgium. And specifically, we hear about the ways that Code Red has targeted private jets. This is, one of the most clear symbols of, you could say climate injustice and economic apartheid in the world, is the growing number of multimillionaires and billionaires who are using private jets. And there's a number of small airports across Western Europe, particularly, that service these private jets. And campaigners in Belgium and also in the Netherlands and other places are calling for private jets to be banned. Also, we talk about a series of actions to protest airport expansion and the use of airports as distribution logistics centers, sort of like warehouse centers, companies like Amazon and others setting up logistics centers very close to transport hubs. This is sort of important elements of modern financial infrastructure that these massive unaccountable corporations are a part of, and through that are directly contributing to climate injustice. So I will let the rest of the interview speak for itself. It was great to talk with Ruth Marie, and here is our conversation. Right now, the climate justice movement is not necessarily a focal point around intersecting global crises, but this does not mean that the crisis has faded. Ruth Marie, you've been involved in organizing climate justice actions in the context of the EU, but specifically in Belgium. Maybe you could introduce yourself and just describe a bit the actions and the organization that you're part of.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for the invite. So I am the spokesperson for Code Red, and Code Red is a climate justice movement in Belgium trying to get as many activists together as possible for civil disobedience. And so that's our mode of operations. And so far, we launched with a first action in 2022 against Total Energies, which you might also know in Canada, big oil giants. And then the second action was against a Belgian oil company, Engie. And then the third action was last December against two regional airports in Belgium, looking at aviation in general. And through these two airports, we kind of tackled the different issues with aviation and the injustice of it. That's Code Red. It's really a sort of activist-led movement. And together we pick targets related to climate injustices.
Well, I'd like to get into the details of this recent action around the aviation industry. But first, I would just ask you about sort of a situation we're seeing more broadly, where fossil fuel corporations and also governments have really changed their rhetoric around, green energy, these terms, sustainability, etc. But we haven't seen a lot of actual shifts in terms of practice. So I'm wondering, in this context, if you could speak a bit about the importance of action to sort of highlight this distance between rhetoric and actual reality of practice.
Right. Yes, that's a very good question. So indeed, in Belgium as well, we've been seeing sort of a lot of politicians, but also the companies themselves are now talking the green talk. So they are in their advertising, for instance, like Total Energies will mostly advertise on what they're doing on solar, but that's just like a minor percentage of what they're doing in total, and it's actually like decreasing in terms of investments from their side. So we're seeing a lot of talk, but not really the implementation of the talk. And we have in Belgium, like I think many countries across the world, had lots of protest marches over the years. Students were before COVID really vocal, like not going to school on Fridays to protest. And all of the politicians wanted to be seen at those protests too. But then in the end, what happened, right? And so we're seeing a lot of frustration with, okay, what happens after we march? And we continue marching because obviously it's important and it's also a good connecting moment to together be on the street. But we sense that just demonstrations and just legal actions are not enough. And then when we look at history, we see that also the major societal shifts did not happen just with a couple of legal protests, but they were the result of years and years of really targeted campaigning, often involving civil disobedience. And so that is why we consider civil disobedience to be a really useful method to be used now also for demanding climate justice. In many places, Extinction Rebellion kind of... Yeah, it was very visible doing that. Greenpeace has been doing that for a long time. There have been grassroots movements across Belgium doing that for many years already. And we felt like if we just bring all of these movements that already exist together, we can have so many more people and do like really cool things like blocking an airport or blocking two airports at the same time. So that's kind of where this came from. On the one hand, a need for civil disobedience, because, yeah, we're simply politicians are not hearing us when we do not engage in activities that are more uncomfortable for them. And also the media don't necessarily give enough space to what it means to protest and to the protests that are happening. So when we have 50,000 people at a march, there's a few articles, but it's not the kind of sensation you get as when you... engage in civil disobedience. So that on the one hand, and on the other hand, just the urgency of all of it means that more than ever, we need to unite in our actions so we can each stay in our own little island, in our own organization. But it's really the goal to bring all of these movements together.
For those listening and sort of feeling what you're saying around the urgency of climate change, could you share a few points around the climate emergency that have stayed with you that you've been thinking about in terms of the situation we're facing?
I think for a lot of people in Code Red, in Belgium, a moment that has stayed with a lot of people, I think it's floods we experienced in 2021 in the summer. These floods also happened in Germany, parts of the Netherlands in Germany. There were a number of fatalities, the same in Belgium. I think we were over 40 people who passed away in the floodings, including a young girl. I think she was 15, Rosa, and her close friend is a friend of mine, Ben. He just saw his friend being like taken away by the water and has ever since not stopped campaigning for climate justice, but also for commemorating all of the people who have passed or who have suffered as a result of climate change already, because it's not a thing of the future anymore. We're seeing it very much here and now. And I think for a lot of people in Belgium, this was a shifting point. We saw, okay, it's not just the global south who will feel this, but also us here, we are very much affected. And somehow a flood also just leaves a harder mark on people at this point anyway than a drought or a heat wave, because it's more visible. And in that summer of 2021, we saw lots of people going in solidarity, helping to rebuild houses, to clean up. But we did not see the resulting climate action. climate policy did not change. I think the only thing that changed was like laws of where you can build houses when there's a risk of floodings, which is also important for preventing future, sort of being prepared for future floods, but it does not tackle the root of the problem. And so this, I think, it's these kinds of moments that remind us of the urgency. But many of us also have images like burned on their, how do you call that, on their irises of wildfires. This is not something we have had in Belgium related to the climate catastrophe, but in other places in Europe, it's been very visible last summer. It was kind of a summer of fires. Canada has had its share as well. And these are the kinds of horrifying images that remind you of what it means not to act and just how sort of powerless we are in the face of like the weather. So how much we need to act to and act quickly to prevent extreme weather events from getting more frequent and worse.
Can you just underline why you feel EU politicians aren't doing what they should be doing on these issues?
Yes, right. So so in Belgium, Belgian policy is top of mind, but we are also always thinking about European policy. And as you rightfully point out, at the EU level, not enough is happening. There was a Green Deal, an EU Green Deal this legislature. We have a new sort of European Parliament coming in later this year after elections in May. But thus far, when we sort of add up like what has happened, this Green Deal has been weakened so badly. And actually, as we speak, it's being weakened further because there have been massive farmer protests. Farmers have been protesting for very legitimate reasons. They are not getting what they deserve. Many live below, like earn wages below average, and they are getting poorer and poorer. And there's some who are getting richer because the food is getting more expensive, but it's not farmers that are benefiting. So they're protesting for very legitimate reasons, but instead of tackling sort of the core of the problem with the intensive agricultural system, European politicians are now weakening certain parts of the Green Deal that were actually really positive for climate justice. So we're seeing like reduction measures on pesticides being sort of taken back, nature restoration measures potentially being sort of annulled because of the farmer protests. And so all the wrong solutions are chosen because it is an election year, but also in general, because we're seeing big businesses are still really strong at lobbying the European institutions. Even if in general, most people agree in Europe that we need stronger climate measures.
Marie, you don't feel there to be a contradiction between supporting farmers' movements or workers' movements and also seeing a future where climate justice is respected?
Right. So I think working together with workers' unions and farmers alike is to many people in Code Red as well really central to our struggle. Many of us have read Naomi Klein and how she always emphasizes, you know, we are strongest when we are together with the workers. To us, to many of us, and certainly to me, that's really inspiring. And I think with farmers, it's very obvious why we should be allies. It's not an easy collaboration. It's not like we'll agree on everything. But the bottom line is that the farmers will be the first to be affected by the climate crisis. Already we are seeing farmers greatly affected by droughts in Europe this summer. I like hold my heart to see what's going to happen and really hoping for more rainfall over the next month so that the worst can be avoided. We're already seeing droughts in Spain, for instance. So it should be logical that we work together with farmers. At the same time, agriculture is a really great source of greenhouse gas emissions. And in Belgium, we are really big on intensive animal farming. And so most of what we produce is actually exported. It's not for a national market. It is a lot of pigs and cows. And for us to really work together with farmers, we also need to look at radically rethinking how we produce food, how we consume food, our relationship to that whole value chain. And so there's a lot happening in Belgium, actually, on like short circuit food. I don't know if that's how you call it in English. So people consuming more locally. Me, for instance, I am part of this participatory farm where I go and harvest the vegetables. And at the start of the year, we have like a meeting and together we decide what will be planted on the field. And we see more and more movements towards that kind of model. But it's not an easy marriage. It's not an easy cooperation for sure. And we're seeing that, for instance, now with a big farmer protests, many were calling out against an EU Mercosur trade deal, which would mean that like food imported from the Mercosur area wouldn't have to live up to the same standards as food that European producers have to live up to, which makes no sense for farmers. That's like bad competition measures. And also it makes no sense for the environmental movement, because if they are allowed to use pesticides, then in the end, like that also impacts our health and greatly impacts biodiversity in the Mercosur region. So we're seeing that there's a lot of points where we touch and where we agree. And then there's many points where it is harder, but that's really a conversation that we have to have also as a climate movement. And we need to dare to also, yeah, have the conversation with the intensive animal farmer and see how we get what we do agree on and how we can use that collaboration power. Because what we've seen, all of the highways in Belgium were blocked for like a whole week last week. And that is just so powerful as a climate movement. I know a lot of activists were like, we need tractors. These are allies we need to keep, because they can just block the whole country for a whole week. And from our side, I think we have ways to imagine a future that will also be better for farmers too. So it's not easy, but we need to dare to engage in that conversation. Maybe finally, I can add, within Code Red, we also have a working group that focuses on working with unions. So whatever action we do, there's conversations with unions beforehand. And last time in the summer, we targeted a Belgian fossil fuel company, and we had an action together with the union of that fossil fuel company at the headquarters of that company, alongside a blockade at a different site. So construction site for a gas plant. So really, we try as best as possible to just kind of join in. And even if not all of our demands are the same, we try to marry the two as much as possible.
You have focused on the airline industry. I know that Extinction Rebellion in the Netherlands has also done a lot of action on that. This is a very tangible, quick policy action that can be taken around climate change. So as following up from what you said, this sort of policy line is something that can happen quickly. Could you talk about that?
So within aviation, we had a couple of different, more specific aviation related demands. So first of all, I think a no-brainer for most of the climate justice movement is to ban private jets. They are extremely polluting and also just kind of the symbol of climate injustice, because they are really just limited to like a very small elite who can afford them. So alongside with banning private jets, we also pushed for an end to subsidies to aviation. So in Europe, and actually in most of the world, airline companies do not pay taxes on their energy use. So in Europe, it's, as a result, often much cheaper to fly from one side of Europe to the other as a result of subsidies to local airports, but also this tax exemption for aviation. And so a second demand was end these subsidies, because they are also unjust. 80% of the world population has never taken a plane. In Belgium, it's a smaller percentage, but still it is mostly the rich who are flying a lot. That everybody is paying for these subsidies, and everybody globally is paying in the climate impact. So banning private jets and ending subsidies were sort of an easy one. And we believe that always has to go hand in hand with a positive measure as well. So we really pushed for making public transport more affordable and more easily accessible for all. And by making public transport more affordable than flying, you're also going to open up lots of avenues, ways of being mobile across Europe for people who wouldn't be able to afford flying and do it in a just and sustainable way. Then we had a bunch of measures, perhaps more Belgium specific, but another global one was degrowing air freights. So we're seeing in one of the airports in Belgium, one of the two that we blocked, the number of goods entering through planes really surging. And this has a huge climate impact, obviously. Some of these planes also bring in food, which really we should be producing locally, because that also creates unfair competition to our local farmers. And we have really good farmland in Belgium too. So we need to kind of shift away from this like decentralization and delocalization of production and look to more circular models, and degrowing air freight is kind of a big one there. Then for Belgium specifically, we called for stopping the expansions of airports. We're seeing lots of airports are now calling for expansions, asking permits for it. And I don't know if your listeners have a clear sense of how big Belgium is, but I'll emphasize that it's really small. And we have six international airports. So like wherever in Belgium you live, you'll be able to hear an airplane above you somewhere. And so expanding these airports even further will just kind of result in Belgium becoming one big airport. So it makes no sense. And as a result, we also called for closing down some of the small airports that mostly serve private jets, because once we ban private jets, why would we need those airports? And then industry greenwashing is another one we called on to kind of stop that. A lot of airline companies have these carbon offsetting schemes, as if they'll plant like a forest the size of your carbon emissions to compensate for your flight. And that'll cost you like €2, which for sure cannot cover the cost of planting that forest. But also planting a forest is not a good solution to washing away your flying guilt. And it is a great way for companies to kind of work with that guilt and minimize it. I'm not saying people should feel guilty for flying. I think governments should feel guilty for stimulating flying so much and for giving this preferential treatment to the aviation sector. But stopping this industry greenwashing is kind of a basic, and ads for flying are a part of that too. We see lots of ads for a quick trip to Mallorca and this and that. And that's kind of like the type of behavioral stimuli that we should move away from.
Thanks so much, Ruth Marie, for the time today.
Yeah.
That was a conversation with Ruth Marie Henkes, who is based in Brussels, Belgium, and works with a project called Code Red. I'd encourage people to look it up. Their website is code-rouge.be, so code-rouge.be. And thank you, Ruth Marie, for being part of the broadcast today. This has been another edition of Free City Radio. I'm your host and producer, Stefan Christoph. We air weekly on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal at 11 a.m. on Wednesdays, on CJLO 1690 a.m., also in Geogeauge, Montreal, on Wednesdays at 8:30 a.m., on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg at 10:30 p.m. on Tuesdays, on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario at 11:30 a.m. on Wednesdays, on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria, BC, on Wednesdays at 9 a.m. and Saturdays at 7 a.m. On Met Radio, 1280 a.m. in Toronto at 5:30 a.m. on Fridays. And on CKCU 93.1 FM in Ottawa on Tuesdays at 2 p.m. You can find our archives at soundcloud.com/freecityradio. And we are also a podcast. Look us up through Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Thanks for tuning in, and I will talk to you soon.